From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the film The Hunting Ground, an Oklahoma State professor nicely sums up the real issue about sexual assault on American college campuses.
I think a lot of parents think, well, we'll drop our daughter off, she'll have a great college experience, and everything will be fine because the college has a reputation for being a safe place. It's not.
The film premiered at Sundance this year, and it reveals sexual assault as an epidemic. Up to 20% of undergraduate women are assaulted, but 88% don't even report the crime. Today in the program, we're talking about why, with the film's producer, Amy Ziering. What is it about the system, the culture, the money in higher education that can make a campus a hunting ground? Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Amy Ziering and Kirby Dick's documentary, The Invisible War, about sexual assault in the military, was nominated for an Academy Award in 2012. And there are a lot of connections between that film and their latest, called The Hunting Ground. The new film is also about a big, entrenched institution that has an epidemic of sexual violence and is reluctant to confront the problem, and in fact seems to regularly look the other way. The Hunting Ground is about sexual assault on the country's college campuses. And like they did with the military, Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering looked at the system and the culture to explain why it is one in five college women will be sexually assaulted and why 88% of them don't report it. It has many of the same elements of the invisible war, this film, apathy and victim blaming and hostility. But it's also, of course, about how money and protecting the brand of these schools can stand in the way. It's also a very, we should say, intimate portrait of some very strong young women and their efforts to change this system. Today in the program, we are continuing our documentary series called Through the Lens, talking about The Hunting Ground with Amy Ziering. We're going to be screening The Hunting Ground next Wednesday evening at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's our partnership, of course, with the Utah Film Center. We'll give you the particulars about that a little bit later on the program. Amy Ziering is a two-time Emmy Award winner and an Academy Award nominee. She's produced several documentary films in collaboration with the director Kirby Dick, including Outrage and, I mentioned, The Invisible War. She's joining us today from a studio in Los Angeles. And Amy Ziering, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I guess I wanted to begin with when you were doing the work for The Invisible War. Is that when the idea for doing The Hunting Ground came to you? Did you, what was the idea? I mean, I'm just wondering what the influence of the, you know, the Invisible War is having on your thinking about doing this film.
Well, it had an influence, but not in the way one would expect. We actually had no intention to make this film whatsoever, even when we had completed Invisible War. We actually had moved on to a project in a completely different area, as we normally do. We don't usually stay in the same sphere. But in the course of simply doing the outreach, the rollout of Invisible War, what we did was, which we typically do, is we screen the film on campuses around the country, just like we screened it in other environments, you know, any kind of, you know, civic forums, synagogues, churches, theaters, etc. But when we found we screened Invisible War on campuses, every time we were on a campus, someone would come up to us and say, you know, something extremely similar happened to me here, and the reaction I got from my administration wasn't far from what you depicted happening to soldiers in the military. And we kept hearing this over and over again. Kirby and I would sort of split up and do these Q&As because there was such a demand independently, but then we'd trade notes. And we just were commenting, gee, that's so strange, and I didn't know about that. And I, in fact, had a daughter at that time who was a sophomore in college, and I felt sort of taken by surprise myself. This wasn't on my radar. And then we started getting letters from around the country from students saying, dear Ms. Ziering, dear Mr. Dick, will you please make a film on campus assaults? I was raped, and they did nothing, et cetera, and we really need a film to shine a light on this issue. So after about 3 months of that, we started we started doing our own investigating and found out not only what we were hearing was as bad as what all the students were recounting to us, but even far worse. And then we just felt compelled. We thought, we can't not make this movie. And so we dove in and made The Hunting Ground. But it really took us as much by surprise as the film takes audiences by surprise, because the news in it is really shocking and revelatory, yeah. And you absolutely are not getting it anywhere else.
Yeah. It's interesting. You did this interview when you were promoting The Invisible War, and you mentioned to an interviewer that when you were talking to some of the survivors who had been sexually assaulted, that it gave you this real sense of anxiety. I mean, you have three daughters, and you said at the time, on some level, you kind of started to feel the elements of post-traumatic stress disorder, the sense of anxiety talking to them. And I'm wondering if the same thing kind of happened to you with this film, if it took its toll on you, because you were the one that were doing the interviews with the survivors.
Yeah, I put some protections in place this time around because I sort of knew that can happen. And I think what that shows, the fact that I, who simply have no first degree relationship to this kind of trauma, yet experienced the symptoms of the trauma in a secondary way. I would like to say that everyone should take that as a warning about the ripple effect these kind of traumas have on our society at large, and why we all need to take care of all our survivors and really address this crime in a serious way, because it does have a ripple effect impact, even if you're not first degree related. But yeah, I did experience secondary PTSD after making Invisible War, and then I, you know, started doing things that would help me in a different way with this film. And yeah, but I don't like to really talk about me. That's not what's interesting. No, what's interesting is the impact that these that what's startling and I want people to realize is how impactful this is. And if it's impacting me, then it's really hurting everyone, all the loved ones of these people and all the ways in which they interact throughout society. So we really need to take care of this issue, and we can.
Let's start with two of the central characters. A lot of incredibly powerful stories and profiles, of course, in the film. But in many ways, kind of the heart of it are these two characters who went to University of North Carolina, UNC. Let's talk a little bit about them. Andrea Pino grew up inner city Miami. Her father came over from Cuba. Her mother was a second generation Cuban America, really the first to leave Florida and go off and go to college. And then Annie Clark. She's from North Carolina, straight A student. Talk a little bit about these two and why you decided to sort of use them as sort of the central characters to tell a bigger story.
Well, when we do any kind of film, we go out very wide and we start following a bunch of different people. We never know, you know, it's a documentary and it's not a reality show. So we really are sort of just following the story and not sure where it will go. And then it became clear about, and it was, there are fortunately, and the reason you're hearing so much about this issue in the media at large for the last 2 years is there's a lot of great activists working in the space. So we were following a few different groups of people. But it became pretty apparent, I guess, in the editing room that Annie and Andrea would be our spine. I mean, when we first talked to Andrea, she was a resident advisor in her dorm at UNC. And, you know, 20 months later, she was literally having, you know, meetings in the White House about campus sexual assault. And you don't usually find that kind of arc in a subject accidentally, and we stumbled upon it. So, and also, you know, you mentioned the parallels to Invisible War, but what is different about The Hunting Ground and significantly different is that there was this incredible activist movement that we could also capture in real time, the likes of which we really haven't seen for decades in America, and certainly not seen in this way, thanks to sort of the advent of social media, which has fueled and empowered it and allowed it to sort of go forth in a way we've never seen in our culture. So we were able to sort of track that and document it, and that's sort of how it came about.
I want to play a clip so we can get a sense of Andrea Pino and Annie Clark, and they talk about their experience of being sexually assaulted. So just so people know, that's what they're going to hear. They're going to talk about that. I wanted to ask you, Amy Ziering, how you approached not only getting these women, and in some cases men, which we'll talk about, to tell that sort of intimate story and how you wanted to portray it. I mean, one of the things I've heard you talk about is that in some cases you interviewed some survivors who didn't really want to be on camera, so you shot them in the shadows. But In the end, you didn't use any of those. I mean, all of the women who talk about those really powerful, terrifying moments are right in front of us.
Yeah, and that was a lot of Kirby's decision. I mean, the thought behind that is that, you know, it's much more compelling if you actually can see a person and identify with them. You identify more empathically. Also, with all the crazy concern about the veracity of these stories, we felt it would be more powerful and effective, you know, to only have people appear that are on camera and willing to go forward and be public about, you know, what they were saying had happened to them. It's, you know, it's sad that you need that kind of level of whatever proof or exposure for this issue to be taken seriously or believed. Mm. But it's true.
Here's a clip from The Hunting Ground.
The first few weeks, I made some of my best friends, and we're still really, really close to this day. But two of us were sexually assaulted before classes had even started. It was at night. We were dancing. I was out with some friends. People were drinking, but nobody was ridiculously drunk. And I got pulled outside and banged my head against a wall and was raped. I physically fought and got away and ran, and then into the bathroom. And I still remember just putting my hands on the sink and just looking at myself in the mirror, shaking, like, what just happened?
My sophomore year, right after spring break, a really good friend of mine said, hey, you know, you want to go to this party? And it was pretty late in the night. I started dancing with this guy. He was really attractive and a really, you know, really great dancer and just a really good person, at least I thought he was. It all happened really quickly. I was actually a virgin, so that adds a bit to it, but he just started kind of like pulling me towards the bathroom. He grabbed my head by the side of my ear and slammed it against the bathroom tile. And it didn't stop. I couldn't move. I could hear the laughter outside the door. I could hear the people dancing. And it made me wonder, why does nobody see me? Why does nobody come to the bathroom? Why am I not screaming? When you're scared, when you don't know what's happening to you, you just stay there and you hope that you don't die. And that's what I was hoping, that I had more than just 28 years to live.
I think, you know, where the story really starts to take its form also is the reaction then. Because in Annie's case, and I think in Andrea's case as well, and I wanted you to talk about that. I mean, Annie mentioned that she didn't really know how to report. She was reluctant to do it. She talks to a friend who says, look, she didn't know what to do too either because she had been assaulted. And so she goes to an administrator, and I wanted you to talk a little bit about the reaction that she gets, this metaphor that she receives, and what that says about the way the system deals with things like this.
Well, what we found across the board was, and it was so startling to us, was every time we talked to survivors, when they described what happened to them when they reported, they were met with, you know, disbelief, with a lot of challenging about their behavior rather than the behavior of the predator or perpetrator. Their motives were questioned. I mean, they seemed like they were the ones under interrogation and suspicion as opposed to, you know, the crime they were reporting. And we just found that over and over and over again. And Annie and Andrea described that reaction from their administrators in the film. And then also we have, you know, a montage from students from around the country, each sort of just iterating what had been said to them. And the comments are startling. I think Alexandra Brodsky, a Yale survivor, said that the evidence she showed in which, you know, could only prove that the assailant loved her. You know, it was just an act of love and compassion. It was things like that got even more crazy. Yeah, so that was really shocking and surprising, and even shocking to the students themselves. I mean, we saw this with Invisible War, too. I mean, they assumed, like we all do, that the institution's kind of going to be on their side and have their back, and it was you know, these are young kids. You know, this is college is a once in a lifetime dream experience, as it's been sold and portrayed in our culture, you know, and everyone believes. And then so they just sort of naively and gingerly say, hey, this horrible thing happened to me, thinking that they'll get the support and the horror and the judicial response, the just response, the ethical response that you would expect. And instead, the complete inverse happens. Mm-hmm. And they are completely flipped out by this surprising reaction. And that's, you know, you watch that in the film. Which also, I'll say, since you talked about PTSD, one thing I'll say is if the first responder it really is not compassionate, it compounds your trauma exponentially, actually. So, often these students would, once they were faced with this kind of skeptical or victim-blaming reaction, they would go very internal and self-harm and have a much more full-blown symptoms than they would have otherwise if they'd been met with a more sympathetic ear and a more just response.
This is the point of the film where we come to what seems like the first big structural issue here in this system. And that's the fact that the institution's first priority is the institution, and that kind of crass term that comes up in the film, protecting the brand. Talk about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, we saw that. I mean, it made no sense, again, as a parent. It was sort of counterintuitive. I assume the institution, you know, the students are, you know, the clients, and wouldn't they be on their side? But actually, they're more afraid of protecting themselves against lawsuits and protecting themselves against sort of adverse, you know, possible publicity in public relations. And also, I think they're susceptible to the same sort of rape culture myths that the rest of our society at large is. So they treat this crime as much less serious than it is, and they don't really understand it and are not trained to understand it. I think when people ask me what's the one thing you would want to have changed, I would say that it's that we really understand rape as a sex crime and a crime in our society like no other, and we really try and destigmatize it and not have it be something where a person is afraid to report or feels somehow shamed or culpable or made to feel culpable, you know, for this happening, just like any other crime in our society. Because also, as statistics show, and as we show in our film, 92% to 98% of rape reports are true, which is statistically the same with any other crime in our society. And yet you don't see that kind of reaction, which means that only, you know, 2% to 6% to 8% are false, which is, again, the same with any other crime. And yet you don't see people meeting someone who reports a robbery or a carjacking or a petty theft or any kind of other crime met with disbelief, skepticism. What were you wearing? Why did you walk down that alley with your purse? We're not sure we're going to help you. We think it maybe you invited this crime. I mean, it's just crazy. So schools were operating under that same sort of bias and rape culture mythology as well.
So what do you think you understand about why it is that campus administrators are overly concerned about false reporting? And I wanted to sort of underscore what you said, because you said it was between the same percentage of false reporting occurs in rape as it does in any other crime, something like between 2% to 8%. And as you said, which means 90%+ in a lot of cases, 95%, 98% of these reports are not false. So how do you understand that campus administrators are worried about false reporting? Because this is one of the myths you hear about a lot, is that, they're just falsely reporting, or they're trying to protect young men from false reports. And what do you understand about that, having done this film?
Well, I understand that really it is highly unusual for someone to falsely report a rape. In fact, and I don't have the studies to back this up, but just anecdotally, you would have to be really crazy to falsely report a rape, because there's no glory in it. In fact, you know, there's just harassment and blowback and shame around this crime, and it is so stigmatized. So not only, but, you know, six studies support and show that it's, yeah, the average is about 95% of rape reports are true, just like 95% of all crimes in our society are true, because really most people have better things to do with their time than falsely report a crime. And also, you know, there's this strange mythology that, you know, you wake up later and you regret what you've done. I mean, we've all been in situations where we've had intimate experiences that maybe weren't what we had wanted I'm not saying that was a forced situation, but just, you know, but we all sort of, you know, take responsibility for those situations and move on. And it's not like then we, you know, want to, you know, make fake allegations as a result. And I just think our culture has a real misperception of this issue. But your question was about why administrations. I mean, I don't have a different answer. As I said before, I think they fall prey to the same rape myths. And also they're incentivized to cover this up. They don't want to see a problem on their campus, and they don't want bad news coming out about their campus. They don't want to affect admission rates. It's very competitive. They don't want to have donors ask questions or, you know, withhold donations. So there is an incentive for them to turn the other way if they can. And see, the third part is these crimes are very hard to prove in a court of law beyond a reasonable doubt. So they can sort of take cover under that and go, well, you know, maybe it didn't happen. Let's just ignore it, as opposed to, you know, let's believe the survivors and let's put sanctions in place that can really meet punishments to bring down these numbers.
Amy Zeering is with us. She produced the documentary film along with Kirby Dick, The Hunting Ground. Next Wednesday evening, we're screening the film at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Director Kirby Dick will join us after the film via Skype for a Q&A. Seating for the show, I should mention, is limited, so we advise you to arrive early. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our series on documentary films, with the latest from director Kirby Dick, producer Amy Zeering. It's an expose on what they call the epidemic of sexual assault on American college campuses. The film premiered this year at Sundance, and it challenges this idea that most parents hold: college is going to protect their kids. The conclusion in the film is that in a lot of cases it won't, certainly not in the case of sexual assault. What Dick and Zeering found are these big structural obstacles. Money is a big one, of course. The taboo of rape is another. Amy Zeering is joining us today to talk about the film. We're going to be screening it next Wednesday, and we'll give you the particulars about that as we go along. I want to ask you about, there are a number of really powerful stories, obviously, in the film. Camilla Willingham, tell us a little bit about her, because I wanted to talk about her story.
You know, I prefer for survivors to tell their own story, honestly, and because if I say anything wrong or get it wrong, it causes problems. But she's, you know, the small part I will say is she's a graduate of Harvard Law School, and she had a case come up there. But she's just, a really amazing person.
She, I think what's interesting about her story is, you know, her mother's in the film, talks about the fact that when she was assaulted and a friend was assaulted, they just sort of presumed Harvard would do the right thing. But let me play a clip here. This is Camilla Willingham, because the university told her to just keep it quiet.
I went to the dean of students' office, and she said, I just want to make sure, like, above all else, that you don't talk to anyone about this. It could be bad for everyone if people started rallying around, like, having him removed from campus. And I was like, well, he's a predator, and he's dangerous, and actually that's exactly what I want. We both had the right to legal representation. My lawyer was pro bono.
She was a phenomenal client. She really told her story with a great deal of confidence.
I went into the hearing, and even the professors were like, did I give him the wrong message with our friendship, and that he misunderstood our friendship? My response was like, no, because, you know, sex was never part of that friendship. And if we were ever going to be introduced, when I was awake would be a good time for that. I'm getting questions like, why didn't you fight him? And he's like, I think like 6'3", over 200 pounds. I was unconscious or just coming to. I like could barely take control of my own body, but why didn't you fight him? There was this extreme reluctance to believe me.
We also heard Colby Bruno, her attorney, in there. And Camilla's story, I wanted to ask you about Amy Ziering, because it has this kind of twist. They found that he had, in fact, assaulted her, but when she returned to school, her assailant was going to be allowed back into school. And this question of expulsions comes up in the film. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, well, what we found time and again was that schools have classic historically and over the past decades meted greater punishments on people who cheat on exams than on people who commit rape and are found culpable of committing this felony assault on their campuses. And time and again, they would just rather turn a blind eye to this crime than actually engage with it and take it seriously. And like the military, when you ask, obviously rape's a problem in our culture at large, but what's so unique or why focus on campuses? Because campuses provide perfect storm conditions for these crimes to be committed with impunity. And when you don't have sanctions in place or any kind of proper investigation and adjudication processes to hold perpetrators accountable, repeat offenders can keep offending ad infinitum and will do so. I mean, we interview a perpetrator in our film, and he says just exactly that. It's a target-rich environment. It's predator behavior. They know how to sort of choose their victims wisely with calculation and premeditation. Alcohol is used as a weapon. It's a weapon to render the victim more vulnerable and embolden the predator as well, who's never as intoxicated as their victim. And then what happens though is then when it's reported and not taken seriously, the perpetrator is not held responsible and now understands how to commit this crime even better and better with each successive time and continues to do so. I mean, we had so many people say to me, I had so many people over the course of the last 2 years say to me, I didn't want to get a report and I didn't really want to say anything. But when I found out he did it to someone else, I felt so bad and so guilty. I felt I had to come forward and talk about it because I don't want this to happen to anyone else. I mean, and you hear that over and over again in our film.
You have this, you list this kind of, I have to say, sort of extraordinary litany of schools and the percentage of expulsions compared to the percentage of reported sexual assaults. I was just struck by it. I mean, this is one of those things that kind of seems outrageous. A Harvard, for example, 135 reported assaults between 2009, I think, and 13, 10 expulsions. Berkeley, 78 reported assaults, 3 expulsions. At Dartmouth, over the period, I think it was 10 years, 155 reports, 3. Stanford was the most shocking, I have to say. I mean, since 1996, Stanford, according to the film, had expelled only one person for sexual assault, despite, 259 sexual assaults being reported. I mean, that seems outrageous.
No, it's really totally outrageous. In fact, I was at Stanford last night, and apparently someone who was found responsible for sexual assault, for rape, was given a suspension after graduation. Which meant that they had to wait a year, essentially take a gap year before they returned to Stanford for their graduate degrees. So it's hardly a incentive to stop doing what you're doing.
It of course raises questions about the way law enforcement, set aside the university campus system, but the way law enforcement generally responds to sexual assaults. I wanted you to maybe talk a little bit about that, because you point out in the film, barely more than a quarter of rapes reported to the police actually lead to an arrest. So there is a bigger issue here, too.
I mean, that's why schools have to be part of the answer when people say, well, why don't we just toss this to the police, which makes common sense and an intuitive sense. Like, yeah, this shouldn't be even part of the campus. The problem with that is civil remedies in our criminal justice system takes so long, so it just, the time frame doesn't work. Even if it was a just system, which we know it's fraught with problems, but even if we got like perfect training like the speed at which that moves would not be able to address, you know, the immediacy of the need for someone on campus, this to be addressed on campus, you know, more quickly. Mm. So that's why we say schools, for now, it has to be a two-track system. You have to report to your school, and we encourage, but it's totally up to the individual, you know, to report to the police, the state police as well, the local police, because ideally you'd want it to be taken care of in both venues. You just can't toss it to the local police because, you know, I think in many situations, like the investigation takes several years, and then actually the trial. So by that time, you know, everyone's graduated. So there's really nothing, you know, there's been no safeties and no precautions on campus to protect other students. You know, this predator's just allowed to be there throughout his college years, his or her college years.
Right. One thing you point out in the film, I mean, we see this archival tape of you know, protests, and I think there was one in 1979. I mean, which gives you a sense that this has been going on for a very long time. But these numbers just keep. I think the point is they get replicated over and over and over again. Do you get a
yeah? Like,
go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
No.
Well, Susie Struble, a Dartmouth survivor from the 80s, and now sort of an activist. I mean, I remember talking with her, and she said, you know, it's like Groundhog Day. Like, I just cannot believe, you know, that what I'm hearing now in the media, it's exactly, you know, what happened to me, you know, 20-some years ago. You know, and when, what is it going to take, and when will it end? And what we're seeing, though, now, the difference is this social media, is that survivors now are able to network, are able to tell their stories, are able to get support, you know, from each other. And the community, and that has helped sort of bring this to the fore and come out in a way that we've not seen before. So that's a hopeful sign, yeah. Right? We're talking about it, and we're taking it a little more seriously now.
The friendship between Andrea and Annie really builds, and they become activists, of course, but it's interesting, and they really strike upon this idea of using Title IX as a way to force schools to confront this question of sexual assault. And I wanted you to talk about that part, because they do all this research, they start examining case law, and they decide to just sort of on their own file a Title IX complaint. Talk about this part of the story.
Well, Title IX was passed to ensure that you could pursue your education free from discrimination or harassment based on your gender. So they decided to use that regulation as a way of holding schools more accountable, because they weren't finding any other recourse. So when people say, is Title IX the answer? Well, Title IX's just a means right now. It's almost like taking a penknife to a granite boulder. It's not really the best way to approach this problem, but it was sort of like the only way these women saw they could be heard or even, you know, get their case recognized. So they're using that tool. So it's what activists are using now, but everybody's sort of looking for something else that might hold more leverage or sway than Title IX. But for now, you know, the Title IX complaints are sort of what the default for what most survivors are doing when they're getting no response from their university otherwise. And I think there's like 106 claims now filed against 106 different universities right now for their failure to properly address the sexual assaults on their campuses and provide a safe climate and a safe environment for all their students.
The social media part of this, I think, is interesting, certainly in the case of Annie and Andrea, because the New York Times did an article, and it seems like it just they were mentioning, and you see this too. I have to say, I really like this element of the film, is they're constantly looking at their phones, constantly on their computers, because they're just getting really swamped with people who said, you know, me too. I went this too. And they wanted to get involved, and they wanted to really, I guess, tell their story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when that's been there. That's when what they've been doing, and you know, what's so sad, and we show at the end of the film is that, you know, this father from whose daughter was assaulted at UC Santa Barbara, when he was getting no response from the administrator, he reaches out to Ani and Andrea, and you know, these are just these kids, and here's this, you know, 40-something-year-old dad calling these students because no adults would sort of listen to him or help his family, and that, you know, just to me was so heartbreaking. I mean, when we got played that the tape of that phone message, you know, we were like, wow, you know, that's just so tragic, and we really should put that in the film so people really understand how bad it is.
Amy Ziering is with us, producer of the documentary film The Hunting Ground, which was directed by Kirby Dick. She is joining us from a studio in Los Angeles. Next Wednesday evening, we're screening the film at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Kirby Dick will join us remotely for a Q&A after the film. You should get there early. Seating is always, of course, limited. We'll have details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with producer Amy Ziering. We're talking about the documentary The Hunting Ground, which she produced in collaboration with the director Kirby Dick. It premiered at this year's Sundance Film Festival. We're screening it next Wednesday night. It's about the epidemic of sexual assaults on college campuses around the country. I wanted to ask you about athletics in higher education, because this is the part that really complicates this story. Of course, you tell the story of Erica Kinsman, who was assaulted by Jameis Winston. Most people will know that name. He was a star quarterback at Florida State. He's going to be, at least most indications are, he's going to be taken fairly early in the 2015 NFL draft. Talk about this part of the story, because this is another thing that complicates all of this.
Well, not only are campuses, you know, places that allow, you know, repeat offenders to commit these crimes with impunity, but also within campuses themselves, there's subcultures like the fraternity culture and the sports culture, which also have certain elements to them which make it, which incentivize our society to turn a blind eye to the crimes of criminals, you know, within these cultures. And in sports culture, obviously, you know, we lionize and we, you know, we take a lot of pride, not only in our school team, but in our, you know, in the star athletes. And so, you know, schools and also those star athletes, you know, as you said, there's a lot of money that they bring into the school, obviously, especially if the school has a really successful sports team. And that's, you know, that's of a huge value, and it's of such huge value that often, you know, schools will attend, we found, would rather overlook, you know, whatever the behavior of certain athletes were, just so long as, you know, they could keep the franchise intact and, you know, the success of the franchise, you know, going strong. So that's something we look at in our film, and we searched around the country. We wanted something to talk about. We wanted some way and some story to be emblematic of sports culture, and we chose the Jameis Winston story because, A, that was so public, you know, already out in the news, and B, though, people and in the public had only heard one side of that story. So we were grateful that we were successful in speaking with Erica. She had not come forth in the press ever before our film. And giving a more balanced portrayal of you know what that was about, because she has been so sort of wrongly villainized in the media.
Yeah. It's one of the most, I have to say, there's a moment when you ask her how she's feeling affected by this, and it's one of the most powerful moments in the film. Where she basically says, you know, why me? I mean, she doesn't say a lot in that moment, but a lot is really conveyed in her expression and her face. It's a It's a remarkable moment.
No, it's just so sad. I mean, again, she was just, she didn't know who he was when he assaulted her. I mean, she called 911. There's a voice record of it. Her friend called 911 and they asked, do you know who your assailant was? And she says no. So all these allegations, she's a gold digger. She did it for success. I mean, you know, she calls 911 in the middle of the night and then goes to the emergency room. And, you know, there's bruises, there's evidence. You know, this isn't someone who's looking for a claim. It's just so crazy.
Yeah. Well, it also reveals another element of the film that really people like Erica and others, they're up against a culture. I mean, it's said in the film that this is a very tight community. And so you get a sense of the, certainly in Erica's case, but I'm guessing in a lot of others, the idea of retaliation. I mean, this certainly happened to Annie and others. Death threats, rape threats, cases of vandalism.
Yeah, no, that's why these women and men are so heroic to come forward. And that's why, again, I say, like, really, you're going to just believe survivors, because there's no glory in coming forward, you know, as you see in our culture as it is today. And, you know, there's really no upside. And so, like, why don't we believe them and really, you know, do something about the offenders and not go after the people who have been violated? I mean, it's just really makes no sense.
I want to play a clip from the film which helps illustrate the intensity of these situations involving fraternities, because this is another one of these cultural elements that you explore in the film, where you have this mix of alcohol and a culture that's, you know, described really as this predator-prey relationship. We'll hear Doug Feuerberg. He is an attorney in this film. Also, Megan Warner from Berkeley, Maya Weinstein from George Washington. They're also survivors that are profiled in the film. And we also hear from Andrew Lose, who is a former member of a fraternity in Dartmouth, from the film The Hunting Ground.
Fraternities are essentially unregulated bars. The individuals that are responsible for managing that alcohol are themselves legally incapable of consuming it.
Most sororities don't throw parties because you can't have alcohol at all on the premises, even if you're over 21. So if sorority women want to drink or go to a party even at all, they have to do it at a fraternity where the fraternity brothers control the dispersion of alcohol.
Usually the drinks had Everclear in them.
What's Everclear?
It's a very strong form of alcohol, and the reason why they put it in there is because it would get you drunk quickly.
The idea would be to get everyone so incredibly intoxicated, you know, blackout drunk, that would increase the chances that people would be getting laid. There was certainly something predatory about it. The fraternity brothers took great pride in having a predator-prey relationship with the women that would come to these parties.
How did you, Amy Ziering, how are you thinking about and how did you deal with this question? We've dealt with it ourselves doing programs about sexual assault on campuses. Were you talking about the party culture and alcohol and all of those kinds of things? Because you get this expressed in the film that it's also about how much did you drink, and this whole question of victim blaming then comes in. How do you balance all of those concerns? On one hand, the fact that alcohol, as you say, and is expressed in the film, is used as a weapon at sometimes, and yet it's also used to blame the victim.
Well, I think how you address it is you really understand this crime differently. You know, it's not a he said, she said crime. It's not a case of, you know, remorse. It's not a case of confused miscommunication. I mean, I think we've really, really, really have to understand that. And if there's one thing I hope and think we can transform is that, and that what we saw is alcohol is part of these crimes, but it is deployed as a weapon to render your victim more vulnerable. And also it emboldens the predator. But it doesn't really do much otherwise. It doesn't make it more confusing. It's like any other crime. If you were drunk and were robbed, would that be an issue?
Right.
You know, I mean, if you were, I mean, no. So it's, I just don't even, you know, so again, we really have to reframe our understanding of this crime. It's not poor judgment. It really, really isn't.
Caitlin Flanagan of The Atlantic is featured in your film. She's written a lot about this, all of this. And she says something interesting about the Greek system. Because Kirby asks her this question. He's like, well, why don't they just throw the fraternities off campus? And she says that the colleges have much more to gain from the fraternities than the fraternities have to gain from the schools. So I wanted you to just talk a little bit about that. In some cases, these are contractual relationships.
Well, yeah, schools gain a lot from fraternities, right? Caitlin mentions the ways in which, you know, they often provide housing free of charge to the school. And that's a huge, you know, assist and a relief of a certain burden. More often than not, I think, like, what is it, 60% of donations over $100 million are from people that attended a fraternity at the school. Mm. I mean, that's a serious challenge.
And the members of Congress who are in fraternities.
Members of Congress are more often than, yeah, there's like a huge percentage of congressmen and legislators who are in fraternities. So those fraternal bonds are powerful and strong, and you don't really want to go up against them, you know, because you're gonna face a lot of backlash, and there's a lot of you know, solidarity they feel, right or wrong, to their fraternity, which can have super positive elements. And we hope that if this film gets out and fraternities see it and really understand this issue differently, you know, they'll show that kind of leadership. I mean, most men, I would think, are horrified by this crime once they understand it, and most men are not predators. Or women. So, you know, the hope is, because those cultures are so strong, let's have them step up and show leadership on this culture, on this issue, in a way they really haven't in the past. Own it, you know, understand that, you know, there's things about their environments that can be more conducive to aiding and abetting this crime taking place, and put measures in place to sort of not have that happen and hold predators that are living in fraternities or people that are committing sexual assault accountable. Yeah. Instead of turning a blind eye and covering up for them.
What's the reaction you're getting from schools? I mean, I guess we should point out you pretty much reached out to all of the schools that where questions were raised about how they were dealing with all of this, and it seems like you didn't get a response, at least not from many.
We reached out to many, many schools. We did not get a response from the, they either declined or did not respond. The main stories in our film, those schools, we did not succeed in getting the president to go on camera and talk with us. What we found, though, what was interesting for me, I was just asked this yesterday, was it actually turned out to be harder for us to get a high-level administrator talk on camera for this film than it was to get a Pentagon official to talk on camera for us for Invisible War. That's kind of right. I mean, you said, wow, I was stunned by that, you know, and if you'd asked me before I made either film, you know, if I thought that would be the case, I'd say never. But that is true. You know, there was a really, really high level of fear. And you see that in the film. I mean, we don't have many faculty on camera. We don't have many high-level administrators on camera. You know, those that do appear on camera are either retired. I had a lot of great discussions with people off the record, you know, who really wanted to help. But the level of fear, because there is so much retaliation if you do speak against, you know, your university in any way publicly, that they just felt they couldn't make that sacrifice or calculate, you know, they couldn't afford that to do that.
Kimberly Thieden talks about schools having these big, massive capital campaigns and endowments, and they don't want people disrupting that. Here's Kimberly Thieden from the film The Hunting Ground.
Harvard is in the midst of a $6 billion capital campaign. Donors might be troubled if they understood the magnitude of sexual assault on the campus. I think that's part of the effort to silence the problem. Numerous times I was taken aside by a senior, tenured female faculty person and told the way to make it at Harvard is by being a dutiful daughter. If you hear it, pretend you didn't. If you see it, you shut up about it. Silence.
So what happened to Kimberly Thieden?
Well, she was denied tenure, even though she was like a star faculty member with, you know, a lot of... She was a Loeb chair, which is a really prestigious chair that only the best, you know, faculty members are awarded at Harvard. And she's, you know, really well published. There was no problem with her publication record and really well respected in the field. But she was really vocal about what was going on at Harvard in a way that no one else really was. And it wasn't, you know, she was just sort of, survivors would come to her and confide in her, and then she would speak up and try and be their advocate. And She feels that she was let go as retribution for her having taken these actions. And so now she's at Tufts now, I believe. She got a position teaching there.
There are a number of these cases. Heather Turcotte, I think, is her name, from the University of Connecticut, basically dismissed for her activism on this issue, it seems.
Yeah, that was really sad. I mean, Heather's really remarkable, and this is such a loss for these institutions. I mean, these are really, really smart, wonderful, talented, brilliant faculty, and you're really going to lose them over this when really they're doing the right thing, like they're doing what you would hope everyone would do. They're just, you know, sort of defending the rights of someone who's been the horrible victim of a crime. Like, I don't, you know, it just sort of makes your mind explode because it's so counterintuitive. But yeah, Heather's great. And, you know, she also was really, you know, really one of the few people at University of Connecticut, one of the few, faculty members who was being outspoken about just the need for the university to improve its response. She feels as well that she, even though she had won an Excellence in Teaching Award and, you know, sort of had gone through all the hoops that you need to sort of get promoted, that she was declined a promotion because of her activism.
Yeah.
And we found that was not anomalous. I mean, you know, they're just two that we were allowed to mention and contacted with. But if you notice in the protest scenes, I don't know if you notice, but if anyone watches our film, notice that there's no faculty or administrators protesting with students, which I found really striking. I mean,
wow.
I've been, you know, I was a former academic, and I, you know, was part of protests in the 70s and 80s on campuses. And I remember it was very mixed. You know, you would have admin, you'd have staff, you'd have faculty, you'd have students, you know, depending on what the cause was. But it wasn't, you know, just a student cause. And I don't know why, you know, rape on a campus is thought of as just, you know, a problem the students need to take care of. It's really on our generation as well.
Yeah. Less than a minute left. Let me ask you this. It's this other striking statistic where 95% of college presidents say their institutions are handling sexual assault appropriately. It's interesting. The military seemed really nervous about the invisible war, but that died down as people saw it. And in many ways, the military really embraced it. Are you expecting universities to, you know, to embrace this, even though it's really dicey and difficult for them?
We're not expecting it. We're hoping they do.
Yeah.
We're hoping they see this as a critique and not an attack, which is exactly the response the military did. And, you know, the Invisible War is used as a training tool on many, you know, hundreds of military bases now in the Army and the Air Force. And we would hope that this will become part of orientation at schools, you know, show that kind of courage and leadership. You know, we can do better. This is a problem that has solutions, unlike so many social ills that are much more intractable. And we're looking for those presidents to step up and show that kind of moral fiber and courage and really demonstrate, you know, the leadership they should.
Amy Ziering, producer of the documentary The Hunting Ground, directed by Kirby Dick. She joined us today from a studio in Los Angeles. Amy, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
We're going to be screening the film, of course, next Wednesday at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our partnership with the Utah Film Center. You can get the details for all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.